RCR with Paul Brennan, Reality Check Radio.
So, to the gene technology bill published on Parliament website last Tuesday, soon to be introduced in the House. This is the New Zealand government planning to introduce this new legislation by the end of the year. Okay, set your watches. That's not too far away. Public submissions are not yet open. Instead, select experts and stakeholders have been invited to provide feedback on the proposed bill. Professor Jack Heineman is a professor in the School of Biological Sciences, University of Canterbury, Director, Centre for Integrated Research and Biosafety. He's on the UN's roster of biosafety experts and expert witness to the High Court on Gene Technology in 2013 and 14, which established that gene editing was genetic engineering. Professor Heineman, nice to have you back on our show.
It's a pleasure to be here. Thank you.
So you're one of the foremost experts, but were you consulted? Were you one of those stakeholders or experts that government are talking to right now?
No, I'm not. I'm not part of the inner circle or in the history or currently, but I have been over the last couple of months joining with a delegation of people from industry and science and economics who have been knocking on the door at Parliament to try to understand more about this bill and to also assess the understanding of those voting on the bill and just what they're voting for.
So why wouldn't they invite you?
Well, you'd have to ask them why they wouldn't invite me. But it is definitely a certain voice that is preferred to be heard. And that's just turns out not to be mine.
Oh, well. And have you been able to make an assessment on the expertise and, deep knowledge of those that are being consulted at the moment?
No, I'm not going to assess the people who are on the expert panels. But what I would say is that this process has gone so quickly that it is taxing the capacity of officials as well as parliamentarians. It's a complex topic. It has really complex ramifications, many of which have been arbitrarily decided to be out of scope of consideration, such as economics and ethics. And in my view, is being pushed far too quickly under too many conditions of secrecy. I mean, after all, it's only this week that we've been able to see the bill. Yeah. And it's only when it got to Parliament. There's been no access to the general scientific community, economics community, the research community, as well as the public, before the bill has its appearance in Parliament. And I find this to be not just poor process, but in particular, a very damaging way to move forward on a topic that has been so controversial.
Yeah, well, it kind of doesn't make sense to be so much in a hurry. And obviously, there'll be reasons for that. I wonder if one of them could be that opposition is anticipated, and the longer the time frame available, the more opposition and awareness can be generated, and that works against the plan.
Possibly.
All right. But it also shows a certain attitude to what us average, and I'm not putting you in that category because of your knowledge, but people like me, no one's asking me, no one's considering what I might think.
Well, they do plan a select committee process. And from what we understand, it's going to be a normal 6-month select committee process. But remember, that includes time over summer. It'll be a short time to get submissions in, and at peak summertime when people are being asked to do that in the select committee process.
So, but they'll be relaxed, won't they, Jack? They'll be pacified through the talk of gene editing. Because that kind of hides a whole lot of other stuff, doesn't it?
It absolutely does. I mean, there's a narrative, and I think it's a highly misleading and maybe purposefully manipulative narrative to describe a sea change in how biotechnology products can be made, so how genetically engineered products can be made. And that sea change is described as being one in which benefits are only a regulation away from us. If that regulation wasn't there, we would be afloat in gene technology products that made our lives simple and rich. That narrative is there, but it never includes the fact that when you have something so powerful, a technology so powerful, that it could conceivably or plausibly provide you with such a world, it can also do so through, and it can also cause harm at those kinds of scales. You can't have power and only good. And that's the magic of regulation. It's our best imperfect tool for ensuring the responsible use of a safe technology. And the tactic here, the strategy here in this new bill, is to take entire techniques of this technology out of legislative scope. They will not be visible to any regulator at all. And that means anybody can use these techniques anytime, anywhere, on any organism. And that makes...
Wow, okay. Yeah,
that would make New Zealand...
Could I do this in my bedroom? Is that what you're saying? I could do this in my bedroom if I wanted to.
Yes, you could. If this law passes, there, at least as far as we can tell from the reading and from the regulatory impact statement and the description that's been presented by officials, particularly in the media pack earlier this year, that you could do this in your bedroom. The legislative description of a laboratory, for example, is so vague that your home kitchen could qualify.
Okay.
So there won't be what you might imagine to be the way in which these gene technologies have been used in the past. And your imagination would take you to a strict containment facility that is occupied by trained personnel, exposing known organisms and only intended organisms to the processes of the technology, and then refining and testing those organisms before release. Now, that has been both the fact and the imaginary of how gene technology is used. But it's regulation that makes it so. The lack of regulation explodes that imaginary. You can now use these techniques, and I'm speaking from an informed view. We've published on this. You can use these techniques in the open air. You can develop spray formulations that deliver these kinds of tools to living cells in the environment where you cannot control the exposures, what organisms are exposed at any given time, much less attempt to characterize all the changes, unintended changes, that you might want to or not make in all those different organisms.
Well, can I just ask for an explanation here? So when I visualize gene editing, I can see this person with microcontrols and, I don't know, splicing this and splicing that at sort of very small physical size. But you're saying you can spray stuff. I think we've talked about this before. You can spray stuff, and what does that go into the organism and do the editing?
There's multiple ways to deliver it. You can spray, you can rub it on, or depending on the target organism, it can be ingested or inhaled and do its activity in living cells that are exposed.
So the editing is then done in cells.
Yeah.
So you're harnessing... Oh, crikey. This is... All right, so you've done a piece that I'm reading here, headed up, and your name is on it, Predicted Multi-Species Unintended Effects from Outdoor Genome Editing. And I think you've gone through, in great detail, but we don't have time for that detail. But what are the potential unintended effects? You might have just covered a few already initially, but what are they? I think people need to know.
Okay, there's a couple of ones that I think we'll highlight here because they're useful for examining also the implications of this new legislation. So the first unintended effect is that these genome editors aren't really the story. Your attention is being drawn to the genome editor, but we've had genome editing as a technique since the late 1970s. That's not new. We have new refined tools. The new tools like CRISPR-Cas are like electric screwdrivers compared to the old handheld screwdriver in the 70s, 80s, and 90s. And that electric screwdriver has multiple heads, so it is efficiently applied in more species of organisms than it was in the 70s, 80s, and 90s. But the underlying biochemistry, the way in which editing defines a group of reactions, that's been around a long time. The unspoken story, though, is the chemistry that has changed over the last 40 years. And that chemistry makes it possible to package the molecules that do genome editing in such a way as to make them penetrate into living cells of any and all species.
Is that the lipid nanoparticle?
That's one of those chemistries, okay. But there are a variety of chemistries. And they are capable then of delivering this in real time, outside of controlled conditions, at such efficiencies that you no longer need a laboratory in order to isolate what you're trying to get.
Oh, so that's why there's such an emphasis on outdoor.
Mm-hmm.
Because
right.
It gets rid of all the other stuff, potentially.
Well, yeah, you don't need a laboratory, you don't need trained personnel. And the other kind of aspect of this narrative, which I think is like a shiny little jewel that they're trying to draw your attention to, is that it's only the outcome of using a genome editor that matters for risk. And I want to challenge that. The outcome of a genome editing reaction is a hazard. And you need to know much more than just what the hazard is to understand the risk. The risk has an entire trajectory within that process of using gene technology. For example, I may not have the intention to create an organism using a gene technology. These are really powerful DNA damaging agents, these genome editors. That's the other way to describe them, not as precise tools, but as mutagens. They're powerful mutagens. And in some aspects, these mutagens are 1,000 times more potent than radiation sources.
Yeah.
But at the same time, while they're really efficient at making a change where you want them to make the change, they are also more efficient at making multiple changes at once that you can't control.
Right.
And so this is what can happen now in the environment when you're using these agents, even if your intention is not to make an unintended change or a change in an unintended target organ, untargeted organism, but that's going to happen when you start to use it under those conditions.
Yeah. And that could include spraying something, another product that's been engineered, edited in this way, then affecting whatever it lands on.
Yeah, look at it this way. Because these are such powerful mutagens, my intention in using them might be to kill something, not to modify it. I could use the genome editor as a very specific pesticide. Now, I use that word specific because it can be very effective against the thing I'm trying to kill. The problem is, what makes it effective against that thing I'm trying to kill also makes it effective at changing organisms I don't want to kill and I don't want to expose, but I can't stop that from happening. And this is one of the major product outcomes of deregulation. Suddenly now, this isn't just a gene technology technique for the production of some kind of specific organism that's evaluated and tested before release. Now we're going to spray mutagens in the environment. Lots of things are going to be exposed to them. We don't know what comes of that. But it also opens us up to be, in a sense, the dumping ground for failed genetic experiments. You can try and try and try and never get what you want, but it doesn't matter if you produce what you don't want. These kinds of genetic beings just go into the waste stream. They wouldn't do this if you had to use these techniques exclusively in a registered containment facility as we do now.
Sounds to me, just hearing what you're saying and thinking of, you know, what's driving all of this, it seems that there's an overheated enthusiasm for the tool set that's now available. And the interest is in the tool, not in anything else. And I can see how technocrats could get excited by that.
Technologists have always been excited by their tools. It's not unique to this time or this particular technology. They've always been. And since the 70s, in this area of gene technology, it's always been a discussion of the tools. And there's always been a hype about what marvelous things can be made with these
tools. Well, that's how it's sold, Jack. So that's the front for, you know, allowing space for the tool enthusiasm to take place.
That's right. It drives the kind of social license you need to give you the consent to do something. So this is what gets us to kind of the rub point. Why don't we have such wonderful outcomes, such all these climate changing organisms, you know, or climate resistant organisms, after having techniques of such power for 50 years? Why don't we already have them? And is regulation that reason? It doesn't seem to me that that's the plausible or most plausible explanation. In the countries that have been most permissive for the use of these technologies over the last 50 years, they don't have such organisms in the environment or anywhere. They have made lots of claims for such things, but they never appear outside of testing in glasshouses or in laboratories. So there's some problem there that has to be not just regulation. But it's also a bit irksome to me that we've asked over and over again for the research that shows what the true unique regulatory burden is for the production of a genetically modified organism. And it's not coming. The regulatory impact statement from the officials are silent on any research that really shows what the unique costs are to developing a GMO. It's filled with the rhetoric that regulation is the cost, is the burden that is preventing us from having these things, but there's never any solid evidence that shows there's a unique burden from regulation.
Right.
As an example, I've looked at the international literature, and really, the only people who are providing these numbers are also, you know, biotechnology industry organization types who have a reason to try to argue that regulation is terrible. Mm-hmm. And even there, probably higher end figures for regulation are quite modest, especially mm-hmm. when you compare it to other costs in the commercialization pipeline. So, for example, if you were to use CRISPR-Cas or ZFNs, these other kinds of genome editors, these are all patented tools. Now, a researcher like myself can use these patented tools for free. I mean, we have to buy the material, but we don't have to pay a rent on the patent for using them. And that's because for research purposes, patented things can be made available without charge, additional charge, to a research community. But the moment you try to commercialize, then you owe the patent holder a rent. And these are very special patents. These are called utility patents. And utility patents give ownership of the germline when you use that tool. So they own the DNA that's been touched by their tool. That's what makes the utility patent so powerful.
Right, I get it, yep.
And we don't know what those patent holders are going to charge us if we try to commercialize something here from New Zealand's research. Mm. And these are usually numbers that are protected as proprietary secrets. However, just this week, Nature magazine published a figure showing that one license from the patent holder of CRISPR-Cas cost the developers of that product $50 million.
Whoa.
US dollars.
Okay.
$50 million US dollars dwarfs even the highest number I've ever seen for regulation costs. And I challenge our community to say how many red apples they would have to sell to recoup the cost of a $50 million license fee.
Yeah, it doesn't really make sense commercially, like you've just put it. But it gives a huge amount of earning power in the hands of patent holders. And who are they?
And they're overseas.
Yeah. But that's anything right. we do here, are there men in white coats rubbing their hands waiting for the patent shower, you know?
Well, there are secondary intellectual property rights that can be obtained by New Zealand institutions, Crown Research Institutes, universities, private companies. So, for example, if you were to make a gene-edited organism that you thought had commercial value, you would get some kind of intellectual property control over that invention. But because it has a legacy use of somebody else's intellectual property,
yeah, I get it.
You would still have to pay them for that, right?
They'd probably make more than you.
And the cost, the size of your market has to be really big to recoup the costs to them before you ever start making money on the intellectual property that you've registered.
So there's no way that that New Zealand can really do big financially out of this business-wise, is there, compared to the legacy stuff that we do already, which could be threatened?
Yes. We do really well without it. I mean, we are some of the world's best farmers, right? And by all sorts of different metrics. Because biotechnology is a much broader church than genetic engineering. How you water your crops, you know, precision irrigation and all sort, you know, cover crops or carbon sequestration techniques, all of these are really sophisticated biotechnologies. They're just not genetic engineering. And they don't attract the kind of intellectual property rights instruments that make a few people a lot of money. They make a lot of people, namely farmers, a little bit of money each. And added up, hopefully, they make a farmer a profit. But what we're seeing in the patent landscape for biotechnologies that attract utility patents, such as in the United States, the cost of inputs that are protected by utility patents is going up way faster than farm income. As an example, the genetically modified seed market in the U.S., and that's dominated by only four or five plants, that market has gone up nearly 500% in cost at the same time that the conventional seeds have only increased by 250%.
Yeah.
So the costs are not proportionate to the rate of increase in farmer revenues.
Again, remember back when we had Judith Collins on the program, and I remember listing out all the, you know, countries and areas of the world that we are lagging behind. And I remember asking her right at the end of that list, big long list, which I think she thought was very impressive. I said, well, what if they're wrong? What if they're all wrong? And she said, they're not all wrong.
Right.
But how would she know?
Well, there's two things about that list. First, the list is very short. But what they do is they inflate the list by adding countries who are just talking about changing their legislation. Okay. So even if you add in all the countries who have changed or are thinking of changing, you still only get 25% of the world on that list. And they purposefully exclude the 145 countries not on the list who aren't doing this.
Yeah, that's a good point. Yeah, she never mentioned any of those.
The other thing is that the way those countries have changed the way they do things is not the same way we're choosing to do it. The vast majority of those countries only liberalize their regulations for plants. We're proposing plants, animals, and microorganisms. Everything can be treated with these technologies and fall outside, depending on the technique, fall outside the purview of a regulator. Only Australia has done that. And Australia hasn't chosen to deregulate as many processes as New Zealand. We would be the wildest of the wildest west.
Okay. Maybe that's a good place to end it, Jack.
Okay.
Our chat. Thanks for coming on again. And obviously you would be hoping, and I know that here at RCR we're thinking about it in terms of other efforts and campaigns that we've been involved in to try and raise the awareness to get those submitters in numbers submitting, but also, yeah, you know, filling up inboxes of appropriate politicians and people. But thanks for coming on again, Jack. Have a great Christmas and New Year. We'll talk to you again, I'm sure, in 25.
It's always a pleasure, Paul.
The RCR shop has great gift ideas, from great-looking tees, hoodies, caps, tote bags, bumper stickers, and more. The RCR shop is now open at www.realitycheck.radio/shop.